Welcome to the Mystagogy Podcast, hosted by the Adult Faith Programs at St. Stephen Martyr Church in Chesapeake, Virginia. In Greek, the word mystagogy means leading through the mysteries. In the earliest centuries of Christianity, mystagogy referred to the practice of helping Christians to appreciate more deeply the Christian mysteries into which they had been initiated by baptism, confirmation, and reception of the Eucharist. This present program of mystagogy is being developed and taught by Barbara Nicolosi Harrington, a university professor of screenwriting, cinema, great books, and theology. In today's presentation, Barbara discusses the sins of violence in cantos 9 through 15 of Dante's Inferno.
Okay, so here we are in our third thing in hell, and next week will be the last. We'll finish hell next week, and we get to move into the Purgatorio, thank God. But we do sins of fraud and malevolence. I have to say, 3 weeks of just spending all this time reading about hell and all these other things, my spirit is a little depleted, I have to say. But thank God for our delicious dinner. Okay, so just a reminder that the three levels of hell are incontinence, the lack of self-control, carnal sins, sins of the body, and then violence, that is conscious of violation of God's will by, we're going to say, assuming our control over other people. And then finally, fraud, lying and deceit, okay? And that's the darkest level of hell. That's where Satan himself is, okay? Now, I just wanted to start out by talking about what violence is, just a little bit to get at what Dante is thinking by making this really be the center of hell, sins of violence. And really interesting, as Cynthia always says, always go back to the etymology of the word and it will enlighten you. And indeed, the root word of violence is vis, which in Latin is force. And then, but it's also married to the word for violation. So violence is this, and violation means irreverence or profanation, right? So violence literally means I use force to degrade something. I use my power, my agency, and I strip the due reverence of something that I should be respecting, that I should be holding up. So it expands it more than just punching somebody in the face, huh? And it opens it up into a whole other group of acts, huh? So we're going to see that in Dante, that he's going to say that there are acts of violence against nature, that there's acts of violence against self, against God, against others, and he's going to describe what all these are. Yeah, so violent people, for Dante, are those who are assuming a power over others or over reality itself that they don't legitimately have. Okay. So the circles of the violent, we're going to notice now, are distinctly different geographically and climatologically in terms of the sins of the circles of the carnal. So we saw the circles of the carnal, they're, it's like a storm, and it's noisy, and the dog's howling and everything. But now, what you're going to see, what we're going to happen is that Virgil is going to, they're going to go to this river, and they're going to have to cross over, and then they're going to get out of this boat, and it's going to be really scary. And now they're going to get taunted by demons, especially the fallen angels are going to be taunting them, and there's going to be all these creepy mythological creatures. Like, we're really heading into now, metaphorically, a very evil place where evil is actually in control. And he notes this too by saying the stink is so bad by this abyss that we were overpowered. Like, we couldn't keep going. We had to wait until we could actually breathe. Get used to it. That's how bad the stench is now. So you have the harpies. It's the stuff of nightmares. The depths of hell is really the stuff of nightmares. It's almost like Dante was like referencing what he had done and saying, you know what, this isn't bad enough. Like, it needs to get really dark and scary. And so that's what he does, right? It's an evil beyond human reason. At a certain point, Virgil, who is his guide, who he said represents reason, says to him, don't look. Just cover your eyes. And he's going to, even Virgil gets creeped out. We're going to see that he becomes almost, in some places, almost useless as a guide because he himself is so freaked out by what they're going to see. Okay. So divine grace is needed here. And what's going to happen is they get stuck. When they first arrive in the circle of the violent, or right before it, it's so teeming with such darkness and creepiness, and they're being taunted by the fallen angels, and it's just so scary. And they freeze. And then all of a sudden, an angel from heaven comes down and says to the bad angels, back off! Back off. And allows them to go through and continue their journey. So what is he saying by doing this? I think Dante's saying, it was tough enough to look at our sins of the flesh. But now, when you talk about really brooding over your anger, what you're angry about, and then also the lies that you tell yourself are coping mechanisms. This is how I've survived my mother being a... I've created this web of narrative, and that's how I keep walking, and that's how I justify what I do. But now I'm just going to say, if you really try to go into those things without divine grace, it can take you in a much darker place. Because you're almost, it's like you can't dialogue with the devil. And when you talk, when you start to really just try to process your own wounds by yourself, be careful that the devil's voice will be very strong. So you actually have, at one point, Virgil saying when they first arrive and they first meet these heretics who are there right on the verge of they're in between the carnal and the violent, Virgil says to him, be careful how you talk to this guy because he's tricky. And sure enough, Dante fails. And we'll see in a second that he isn't up to it. We're over our head when we try to really look to see ourselves. This is why Teresa of Avila says spiritual directors are so important, confessors are so important, spiritual friends, and then honestly, therapy is a good thing. We all need it. They made us get it as a nun, and I remember being contemptuous and insulted, and then I had to admit it was like one of the greatest graces of my life, 2 years of therapy. Okay, all right, so here we go. We are now heading into, it's the level of heretics here, and the doorway into this, the sins of violence. And the heretics are straddling both worlds, as we said, the carnal and then the sins of violence. But it's a very odd place, right, where you're going to see there's all of these empty tombs, or tombs, and they're all on fire. And then they walk up to them, all of a sudden people keep popping up and saying things, making proclamations, and then dumping down. So for Dante, remember, a heretic isn't Martin Luther. That's not what he's talking about, right? He's talking about, because everybody was Catholic in 1300. The Christianity and Catholicism were one. So basically, a heretic was someone who denies Christianity, who denies religion at all. So these are people who are basically living as though religion is irrelevant. Not necessary. Kind of silly. Ridiculous. I don't have time for that. So this one he meets here, that pops out of the grave, and he describes him this way. Upright, He rose above the flame, great chest, great brow. He seemed to hold all hell in contempt. Because he's denying that he's there. He doesn't believe in life after death. And this is the quandary of the heretics, the atheists, basically, is that they find themselves alive after death, even though they do not believe in it. And so that they all have this bearing of kind of contempt. And so they're, it's just really funny, huh? They're going to spend eternity denying they're alive in their graves. I remember how I said everybody in hell gets what they want. The atheists want to be dead. So they're in graves, and yet they keep popping up when they have something to say. Really brilliant. But so they're walking along, and Dante ask Virgil, who are these people, whatever. And all of a sudden, Farinata pops up out of the grave and says, I recognize your accent. You're from Tuscany, just like me. What family are you? And Dante starts to tell his family, and Virgil leans over and says, be careful of engaging this guy. Anyway, what does Farinata do right away? He goes, oh, my family beat yours twice in war. You're pathetic. And Dante goes, if my people were scattered, at least they came again, not like yours. And so they start having a fight, a political fight here in hell. And then just then, another head pops up right next to him and says, oh, I know you. You're that poet. You used to practice poetry with my son. Where's my son? And he goes, who are you anyway? You know, you're nothing. My son was a good poet. I don't even know who you are. So Dante says, I'm the guy here with Virgil. He and I were like that. So right away here, what you see is this dialogue with these two damned souls in which they start posturing pride and playing these games of my family's better than yours, and Dante gets sucked right into it. Like, he's right into it. You know, Virgil, I'm like, snap out of it! Why are you arguing? They're in hell! But it does show that one of the things is that you have, Farinata says to Dante, predicts the future. Says to him, basically, you're going to have trouble too. And it's like a prediction that he's going to be exiled, whatever. And so Dante says, how do you know the future? And Farinata says to him, we see a squint here, all of us heretics. We see like this. And he says, we don't see the present. Anything that's happening right now, we don't care about. And the past doesn't matter because they've spun their own story. But it's interesting that they see the future kind of in glimmers, and that the implication is that's how they get power over people, is that they can see patterns and say, this is where we're headed here, because they're very intelligent, and that's enough. But it's the squint thing, right? They don't see quite clearly, but they see enough because they're smart. The point is that the irreligious have no sense of the big picture. People who live without God get stuck in minutiae for Dante. That they're sitting there fighting over, that's like at one point he says to him, what about those people you killed? And they start arguing about it. And yes, but that wasn't really my fault. It was his fault and I wouldn't have done, right? All this nonsense. And you say, yeah, that when you don't have God, then you go from looking to seeing this whole big panorama of history and the story of salvation, and instead you get really narrow and you can't see the forest for the trees if you lose the divine perspective. I think that's really true. That's very true. That faith puts us in line. in this story that has been going on for millennia. And it's okay. I think it's one of the reasons the church has the official, one of the official liturgies of the church is the Liturgy of the Hours, where the church compels us to pray the Psalms. And the idea is you're using words that people have been using for 4,000 years. And it puts your own problems in perspective, doesn't it? But people who are irreligious, who are atheists, they can't think of the big picture, can they? Because then you'd have to ask, where did we come from and where are we going? And all he wants to talk about was his victory over and how I prevailed there. I guess the point is, when we obsess over minutiae and when we don't try to put things in the eternal perspective, we're thinking like pagans, not as God thinks. Okay, then we move into the next canto and we meet more heretics. Like, there's two whole cantos developed, given to these people who are irreligious. And right away we meet, I just had to put this one in, Pope Anastasius. And it says, he whom Photinus led from the straight road. Well, Photinus was a bishop who didn't believe Jesus was God. And he was very articulate, and he took a lot of people with him, including the Pope, because the Pope, they had a big church conference on this heresy, and the Pope gave communion to this guy, Photinus. Even though he didn't publicly say he agreed with him, he gave him communion, which everybody interpreted to be, you think he's right. And so Dante puts him in hell. The Pope and Photinus, right, end up there. But anyway, the bigger point, and interestingly, wasn't even Pope Anastasius. It was the Emperor Anastasius. Dante got his history a little messed up there. It wasn't Pope. It was an emperor. But anyway, but the point is that these people are making decisions based on their own, how they think it should be for the church, even. Like, even in the church, it's like, God's will, we don't have time for that here. We have to find a way to make this social justice NGO work better. Just a little note, on the retreat day, February 25th, I'm going to do the three temptations from Dostoevsky's Grand Inquisitor. And this is the sin of the Grand Inquisitor, is he said, Jesus was too idealistic. We need a better system to organize the church. And of course, one of the most evil voices in all of literature there. But this is who we meet, heretics who, so the first heretics we meet are proud, and that's why they make their mistakes. These heretics seem to be people who are equivocating out of some kind of earthly, worldly concern. But they're all in hell. Okay, all right. So now we really cross into the circle seven, circle seventh circle of hell. There's only nine. And what you find is the violent are all on the same circle. So one of the things Dante is saying here is this isn't the majority of souls we're talking about here. The way, remember, the circles were bigger in the carnal, right? But now we're getting narrower down. And in fact, with the heretics, by the way, at one point, Dante says, how many of you are in there, by the way? And he says, oh, there's a lot of us packed in here, almost 1,000. 1,000 is nothing compared to the other levels. So not every, there's not a lot of heretics in hell, or the people that really had no religion at all for him. But now we're at the level of the violent. And so it's going to be one ring, and it's going to have three different geographies, according to the sins and the sinners who are there, huh? So basically, the three geographies are the river of blood, the forest of the thorny forest, or the dead wood, you'll hear it said, and then the burning sands. And each of these metaphors is connected to what violence does to us, and then what the reward of it is in our lives, okay? Good. So Let's plunge into ring one. The first level of violence is the violent against neighbors. Now, this is every level of the violent, every section is guarded by a different, really creepy Greek mythological character that has a particular meaning. This one's the Minotaur. Now, the Minotaur was the product of a lustful relationship between Ares, the bull, and some trampy female whose name is escaping me. And it ends up in a creature who's got a bull's head and bull's legs, but a human torso. So what you have here is a creature that is, it's like all of the rage of a bull and completely irrational, monstrous, out of control rage. So what Dante is saying here is this is the guy who's been assigned to keep the violent against neighbors in check. Because what finally makes people actually get up and hit someone is this rage that just... And so that's the symbol here. Interestingly, the geography here is also described as, and it's a beautiful little section, as, wow, all these rocks like have caved in down the mountain. There's been a huge mountain like earthquake and all the rocks have fallen down. And so when they first get there, the terrain is just is like a place that's been devastated. And then Virgil says, yes, the last time I was here, it wasn't like that. But there was one who, in his death, shattered, an earthquake shattered this part of hell. Of course, this is a reference to Christ, that when he was crucified and when he died, scripture says the earth shook. So Dante picks that up and says, yes, and the level of hell where people are causing other people's blood gets wrecked by the blood of Christ. The blood of Christ shatters that. Just beautiful poetry. Okay, so the violence against neighbors, right, is it's basically there's a river of boiling blood. And the sinners are in the boiling blood because that's where they've always wanted to be. And their whole life, when they got mad at people and their blood started to boil, people said to them, what? Calm down. So now in hell, God's have at it. You get what you want. So they're immersed in boiling blood. And there are these minotaurs who are amusing themselves by shooting at them whenever they pop up. Why? To keep them angry. Because they want to be angry. So it's like, okay, if that's what you want, that's what you get. The first note, so he says, who's here? The kings of bloodshed and despoilment. It's the place where tyrants stew. So Dante's particularly thinking of people who were like caused rivers of blood. That people who really let themselves just have over other men loss of life. But pretty much anybody who took it into their hands to have their way with another person's physicality. I'm going to use this gift of my body to beat your body. And Dante says, you have no right. It doesn't matter what they've done. You can't do it. And so this is the crowd that is in this level of hell, wallowing in hot blood for all eternity. We're going to see when we get to the Purgatorio cures for these kinds of people. But right now, this is where they are. Okay. So it's horrible and it stinks and Dante is really, he's a tender soul, Dante the Pilgrim, and he just wants away from the river of blood. And so they have to really get a ride on one of the minotaurs to get out of there. So they're riding away. And they ride into the middle ring, Circle 7, the middle ring, where the suicides are. But what happens first is they get there, and it's like that scene from The Wizard of Oz. It's all these gnarly trees. And Dante's like, what is this place? And Virgil's like, snap off a branch. And he's like, all right. And then he snaps off a branch. And the tree cries out, why did you break me? Why did you tear me? Is there no pity in your soul? And so it's revealed that the trees in this place, these gnarly, barren trees with no fruit and no leaves, are people who took their own lives. And we meet one of them. So why are they trees? Because they said, I don't want this. God says, okay, I'll make you a plant. Then you can be a plant instead. But again, remember, they get what they want, and they didn't want this. They threw it away. And we're going to talk about this in terms of current church teaching, but this is, I'm just giving you what Dante's saying here, okay? At the end, the last line is, there's somebody in the tree and they're walking through the forest, and Dante goes, wait a minute, who is that guy? And what this is what the soul says, I'm the one who has no tale to tell. I made myself a gibbet of my own lintel. I hung myself on my own door, so I have no tale to tell now. It's very haunting and spooky, that, huh? But they meet this guy, Pierre de Lisle, who's a real person. He was the chief of staff to Frederick II, who was a pretty nasty emperor, but this guy was really good at his job. He made the emperor look really good, and he gloried in that he did his job so well, and he's the chief of staff, he's second command. He says, at a certain point, I did my job so well that envy crept into the court, that harlot, and inflamed all these minds against me, and then they were blaming me for things I didn't do, and so I said, fine, I'm killing myself. I'll show you. And so he takes himself out of the picture, and he says, I was unjustly blamed, and then my soul made me at last unjust to myself. So to prove a point and to take himself out of the insults, he killed himself. This wasn't a rare thing. In the ancient world, and then even in the Middle Ages, if you couldn't, like, killing yourself because of disrespect was actually considered heroic in certain circles. It was like, yeah, he really didn't take that insult. But then the Christianity comes along and is like, we don't do that. So Christianity is a counter voice, and we need that voice again in this current culture. Here's what the Catholic Church teaches. This is from the Catechism on Suicide. And I think just to be responsible, we have to bring more to the table. Dante did not have psychology the way the church now listens to the voice of psychology. But number 2281 says, suicide contradicts the natural inclination of the human being to preserve and perpetuate his life. When Dante puts suicide in the unnatural, like the sins against yourself, the sins against your justifiable or irrational self-love, this is what the church is saying. Yes, that this is, it shouldn't be that someone, instead of trying to survive, is killing themselves. It's very inverted. It is gravely contrary to the just love of self. It likewise offends love of neighbor because it unjustly breaks the ties of solidarity with family, nation, and other human societies to which we have obligations. I don't know about y'all, but we have two suicides on my mother's side. Devastating in a family. Devastating. Forever the family goes, what didn't I do? And I remember my sister Cynthia saying once that suicide makes the unthinkable possible, and it shouldn't be. But it's a thing to do to a family. Now, granted, so suicide is contrary to the love for the living God. The church is going to say, however, it's clear that it's so violation of natural inclination that it is something people do when they are mentally ill. They are really not playing with a full rational or psychological deck when they make this choice. And so it's not, the church used to say you can't be buried in the church. That's no longer. We don't know where, if people have committed final despair or if they were just so broken, right? So we pray for everyone regardless, and so I'm very glad for that. Yeah, but I think having said that, you're like, why do I care about this? I'm not going to commit suicide. Why is Dante distracting me with this? Because he's thinking of more than just the act of ending your life. He's saying the bigger problem of all of these sins of violence is that we take on ourselves power we don't have. And so in the first case, it was the power to make someone else lesser than me, to take a sacred, beloved child of God, someone who belongs to God, and have my way with it. It's my thing. You don't have that power. In the same way, you don't own yourself. And so I owe, as he's saying, the church saying, we owe obligations to our family, to our nation, to the human society, and to God himself. Our life is not our own. St. Thomas Aquinas has a funny allegory for suicide in the Summa where he says, imagine if all the cows decided they didn't want to give milk and smash their heads up into trees. I always thought it was like a funny analogy. But this is like people saying, I don't want my life. I don't want to be a cow anymore. Interesting. Okay. The last people that we meet in the realm of the suicides is the squanderers and destroyers of gifts and goods. The squanderers. Now, when I first read this, I was like, wait a minute, we already met these people, the hoarders and the wasters. But that's not quite what he's talking about. The hoarders and the wasters actually were greedy for creature comforts and gold. Like the hoarders, huh? They wanted gold. They valued it in itself. The squanderers here are connected to the suicide thing. These are people who have been given gifts from God who say, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that. And so they squander their identity in Christ, in God, the reason they were created. This is going to really pay off when we get to heaven, because the thing we're going to see, this is a spoiler alert, but heaven is a big flower in Dante. It's the mystical rose, this massive rose made up of petals that are us. And every petal is distinct and then added to all of the other petals and makes this gorgeous, beautiful flower that is eternally giving glory to God. So it's important that each one of us figure out why we were made. What's my little thing that's going to be the flourish on the big mystical rose? What has God given me to do? I remember once my younger sister, the youngest, is an opera singer, and she used to be always, she was raised to be a diva, but she was always upset that she wasn't getting the right parts and that she worked harder and she had people would show up and just outsing her that were idiots. And she's, I'm being good to God and I'm losing jobs to morons. And anyway, but it used to really bother her. And finally, one day I noticed she wasn't doing that anymore. And I was like, oh, you don't bitch anymore about And this is going out to you, Romania. So sorry, Valerie, I hope you're not listening. But anyway, I was like, you don't complain anymore about your opera career not going where you wanted. And she said, yes, I was angry at God for giving me a voice in the top 10% instead of the top 2%. And in opera, you make a living in the top 2%. And so she said, I was angry at God. She said, but then I finally realized I don't have to sing the best. I just have to sing the best song I can sing. And I'm finding places where, so she moved out of New York and she went to Denver, where top 10% is really good. But that, she could have spent her whole life bemoaning the fact that she couldn't sing in Manhattan. And not sung, or not sung at all. So I think it's just that Dante puts this here, this challenge that we, when Jesus tells that parable of the talents, what have you done with the gifts you have been given? And then we're not just talking artistic talent here. I have one sister who's a genius with people. She's just a genius with people. And then I have the other one who's ridiculous player of Trivial Pursuit. But I think the idea of everybody looking at themselves and saying, gifts of nature, gifts of grace, gifts of family, gifts of friendship. God has given me these gifts, and in some ways, I have to make an accounting for all of them. I just want to ask, why don't people do that? What do you think? Why do we not use our gifts more? Why do people shy away from their gifts? What do you think? Anybody? Yeah, Nicola. Okay, so this is for Romania, because they're not good enough. All right, what do you mean by that exactly? Is it like the Valerie thing of I'm only a 10% singer?
Yeah. It very much relates to it.
Yeah, I'm really good at this, but I'm not the best, and I know enough to know that. Huh, I don't want to look like a chump. Yeah, yes.
We compare ourselves with other people. And we feel like our validation comes from other people.
Okay, so everybody else, I'm comparing myself with everybody else and how they're looking at my gift. And if they don't give me the validation that I want, then forget it. I'm not doing it. Yes, here.
I just think the common denominator would be fear.
Yeah, fear. Yeah, fear. I'm afraid to take a chance and look like a fool. I'm afraid to not be good enough. Maybe I'm not as good as I think I am. And yeah. Yes.
I don't think that a lot of people see their own gifts.
A lot of people don't know their own gifts, and they may not take the time to find them because it's a lot of work. It can be a lot of work, huh? Yeah.
And also, I don't think that most people have been raised up with people pointing out their gifts.
Okay. We didn't, the educational system prioritizes only intellectual gifts, doesn't it? It's been a problem for, very good. So that means the family has to pick up the slack. Huh? What were you going to say there?
Oh, I was on the same line. People either don't know what their gifts are or they fear they have no gifts and don't try to discover it.
Yeah. Now, I don't think God would send us to hell for that, though. Unless it becomes that you deliberately don't want to develop your gifts, you don't want to know. Now it seems to me this is getting at where he's heading, huh? But yeah, good. But way back there, yeah.
So sometimes our gifts can be like idols to us. Like if I'm really good at something, then I become obsessed over it, and it starts leading into other.
Oh yeah.
It becomes not the direction you want to be in.
Okay, very good. Our gifts can become idols. We can lose control of ourselves and them. They can take over. So they frighten us. So we say it's not worth it. Yeah, good. Here.
Loving other things more than your gifts.
Okay, loving other things more than your gifts. So, like what?
Your gift might not be a call to comfort or ease.
Oh, okay.
Or something that's even pleasant.
Okay, very good. Yeah, let's face it, cultivating a gift takes work. It takes work. And you know what, maybe I want my creature comforts more than having to go in that world. I honestly, after working in Hollywood 23 years, it's hard being a writer. It's really hard. I had a producer once tell me about a script. She's like, what was that line anyway? We got a note from MGM. They didn't understand that line on page 17. And I was like, oh, well, it was a little joke to kind of start the scene. And she went, a joke? A joke? It wasn't funny. And you know what? You're not funny. So why don't you just go through the whole script and take everything out you think is funny and just save me some time? See, you're all laughing, which proves I'm funny. But that was like a kick in the gut. It really was. I almost walked away because it was so brutal. So, yeah, back there.
Yeah. Where sometimes you may not actually grab onto them when you do what you think, but you may not know that that's your ultimate gift.
No, it's a great, great point. And so Dante's basically saying, look, find it, because what else is God going to ask you to account for but how you used the blessings he handed you? And yeah, figuring out, what are the blessings? What do I have that I don't even know and I don't value or appreciate, but that's actually something that can help and heal and minister and save. So I love that he's putting this at the lower, a deep level of hell. People who just said, I'm just here for the ride. I'm here to absorb. I'm here to be served. Yes, way back there, Mike.
Yeah, one of the wisest things I ever heard was that your gifts are those things that you don't ever remember anyone telling you, teaching you how to do.
Yeah. Plato says in the Republic, your gift is the thing that you do easier than other men, you learn easier than other men, and that you can innovate in better than other men, which is interesting. And he goes, do that thing, because that means the world needs it. So anyway, yes, yes.
I wanted to comment that sometimes parents can put their children down and not help them flourish in their talents. They grow up thinking they don't have it.
It's just true. And why do parents do that? Because it's a lot of time, isn't it? It's a lot of time to drive my little four-year-old to dance class or whatever. It takes a lot of time. And we just don't have it. Yeah.
If you make your gifts known, couldn't they become too much in demand and just more than you want to?
I suppose that's part of the challenge of them, isn't it? That they, especially people gravitate to us when we show our giftedness. And so that brings in a whole other level of things to manage, huh? I go around and I give a lot of speeches. Not since COVID, but before COVID, I used to travel 2 weeks a month and give speeches. And I would give my little spiel about beauty and art. And afterwards, there would always be one person at least come up to me at the end and be like, you and I are supposed to be best friends. And I'd be like, whoa, later much. But it's like, yeah, people can glom onto you when you have a gift. Somebody has a beautiful voice. Somebody has a, you know, quality of leadership or authority. And yeah, I think that's part of it, is it's not just doing the thing, it's navigating your life with your gift. But we cannot do it. We have to flesh out what God did. So anyway, the squanderers are running naked through the thorny woods. So they're running in between the suicides, being pursued by hungry, angry dogs who are tearing them to pieces and carrying off their limbs. And you're like, why? Why is that? So because they spent their life wasting themselves. So for all eternity, they basically get wasted. All of their gifts are just getting ripped off of them and whatever. Ugh. Okay, don't be them. All right. Okay, the inner ring, the last ring. Oh, here I have to talk about sodomy. Yes, joy galore. Thank you, Jesus. All right. Now, the inner ring, okay. This is a flaming desert, the burning desert. And there are three groups of people in the burning desert in different like parts, and they're all over. And so the first group we meet are the blasphemers, and then we meet what he calls the sodomites, and then we meet the usurers. Okay. All right. Now, basically, the flaming desert, what's going on here? These are sins against God himself. So the blasphemers are saying, they're laying there all over in the hot sand, and they're cursing God. And they're basically, so there's, they meet one, here he is, Capanius in Latin, okay. Anyway, so he's sitting there, and he's from Greek mythology, I guess, but basically he's burning up, and as the fire is coming at him, he's turning his face into it to feel it even more. And so Dante says to Virgil, what's with that dude? And he hears him and says, I don't turn my face away from anybody. And he's one of the seven who fought the Titans in Greek mythology and basically cursed the gods and said, ha ha, as he was climbing on Olympus, and then he gets struck down. So basically, this is a prideful person who is looking at life, looking at the world, and saying, I could do it better. It's a mess. I mean, him. How do you explain him? I'm only kidding. Yeah. But really, you know, that they live in this place of critiquing God for the way he has made the world, the way he's made me. And basically, this is all, again, all this anger. Why didn't you make me more powerful? Why didn't you make me more whatever? It reminds me of, there was an apologist named Frank Sheed. He was British, and Sheed and Ward was a publishing house he did with his wife, Maisie. But he used to do sidewalk, like, preaching in England. And one day he was preaching Christianity in post-war England, standing on a soapbox, and somebody screamed out from the crowd, if I were God, I would have made a better world. And Frank Sheed goes, Win, why don't you make a rabbit just for confidence sake? There's something to that, right? But basically, these three groups we're going to see, the blasphemers, the sodomites, and the usurers, are all furious at God. So what Dante wants us to do is say, why are you angry at God? How has he let you down? And where does it pop up? What's the thing that you are thinking secretly, life would be so much better? Eh. This church thing? Really? I have to go and ask forgiveness from these morons? I've met people that way. I can never go to church because I can't stand Christians. I always want to say the Christians are the only ones who'd put up with you. But, okay. So they're rejecting his sovereignty, his order, and his decrees for mankind. That's what these three groups basically are. So what they get in the burning sand is a world without his sovereignty, his order, and his decrees for mankind. Just nothing but sand. And the fire is there's no shade. It's the accusation of the cosmos coming down on them for their this thing, but it's the vanity of vanities is what they inherit, this group. Okay, he meets the violent against nature, okay? So he's going to meet his old teacher, Brunetto the intellectual. But I love this. When Virgil and Dante first come into this section of the burning sands, it's like all of a sudden there's this group of damned souls, and he says, they stared at us as men at evening by the new moon's light stare at one another when they pass by on a dark road. So they're still looking for action, this group. He meets his teacher, and it's actually a beautiful passage. He's, of all the people that Dante meets in hell, Dante the pilgrim, this is the one who he speaks with the most compassion to. Not the fake kind of Francesca solidarity, but actually compassion. But he says, I learned so much from you. You made me the poet that I am. And the guy is nice, but then he finally says to him, when you go back up there, tell everybody to read my book. Tell everybody to read my book, because that's the only way that I live forever. Okay, what's going on here, huh? The violent against nature here is, he says, we came to a plain whose soil repels all roots. For Dante, homosexuality is not about carnal. He didn't put it with the carnal. He put it with here in the violent against nature, because he's saying it's anti-fertility. It's anti-natalist, if you will, using a contemporary term. That these people reject the normal way for that God meant us to make an impact, which is to be in a family and to pass down our genes, to give the gift of ourself to another this way. And they say no. Now, you have to put this in the context of classical thought. If you've read Symposium by Plato, Socrates meets with Alcibiades, I believe it is, who makes the case women aren't intelligent and they're emotional and you just can't have a good conversation with them. But men are all well educated and we're rational. So having a lover who's a man makes sense because it keeps my whole life together. And Socrates rejects that because he says you're rejecting half the human race, first of all, which doesn't seem to make sense, but also you can't do on your own together the continuation of the race. You're missing 50% of what it is to be human by rejecting the other half. So Dante says that ultimately this is saying to God, no, not your way, my way. And I don't want to live forever according to your terms. I want to live according to mine. Now, he makes this point in listening to Brunetto talk that if you don't have a family who depends on you as a man, and again, this is Dante's opinion, then you are forced to prioritize worldly achievements. Then become your goal. If I'm not trying to get my little four-year-old to learn to ride a bike, then I'm going to be focused on writing my sitcom for myself and whatever. So he says that men without families to answer to can become very much about ambition and, oh wow, competition. And competition is a big thing in him, in Dante. He has it come up over and over. We saw that with Farinata, the heretics, huh? Basically, I'm in competition with you. I'll fight with anybody who puts their hands up just because I want to win. So Dante's implying that family is a good place for men to pour themselves out and sublimate that need to beat out other men, because they're focused on this human community of love, right? So very interesting that his whole thinking here. I think that, again, I should have put the catechism's thing here. This is less about the homosexuality that we know today as the activist kind of thing that we're being constantly assaulted by, if you ask me right now. This is not what he's talking about. He's talking about this bigger issue of rejecting God's way of doing things. Do I give myself permission to opt out of the natural order as I can see it, or the scriptural order, if you will? Okay. The last group is the usurers. Usury. What is usury? Anybody want to just spell it out for those of us who haven't read Venice? Say again?
Unbearable.
Okay, unfair lending. So usury is a sin in the Bible. But somewhere around the Industrial Revolution or something, it stopped being a sin. And credit cards were invented.
It's too high interest.
Yeah. So usury is, they meet the usurers, and they're sitting there bent over on a ledge. So there's this vast, remember, area of hot, burning desert. And then there's the side of it, and there's a ledge. And these people, and there's not a lot of them, but they're all, like, bent over because they have around their neck big, heavy family crests. And they describe a few of them. So the biggest, wealthiest families of Florence is the one that Dante is hitting on here. Yes, the bankers. And that these people only get a ledge in hell. And they're basically bent over. And so Dante goes up to them to be like, hey, what's with you dudes? And right away, one of the souls says, get away from us. Who do you think you are? We don't have time for you. And it's like a really stern, awful, nasty rebuke of these souls who think they're still Ebenezer Scrooge. Okay, usury. Why is usury here in this level of hell as a sin against industry, a sin against work? Anybody, put that together. Why does Dante put usurers here? What do you think?
There's no, it's not producing a good or a service.
Very good. It's not producing a good or a service. But these are people, so we've been given the mandate to cultivate the garden. We are all meant to work. Part of that is our gift, giving back our gift. I got to do my thing and you have to do your thing. Usurers have figured out a way to survive without doing any work. What they do is they make you work and they get a cut. So they themselves are not actually decorating the planet, decorating creation, adding a flourish. They are profiteering off of somebody else's industry and probably making that person, like, oppressed, too. Stifling that industry, huh? Really interesting. Yes?
Isn't that what happened? The interest became so exorbitant that they became slaves to the person they owed?
Yes. Yeah, the interest would become so extravagant that people are literally slaves, which makes them not able to really give their gift. Yeah. Because they're being worked so hard and so menially, etc. So basically, these are people who are saying to God, I'm not working. Screw you. I found a better way. And they're rejecting having to live by the sweat of their brow, which is what we hear in Genesis. Okay, so I guess the last challenge for us from the level of the violent, huh? The first thing I would ask you is, have you ever raised your hand against another person in violence? And to brood over that boiling blood, what made my blood boil? What was it that brought me there? And then what was the effect of it afterwards to really truly see it? But I would challenge you to look beyond just the physical act of hitting somebody. And I was saying this to the RCIA people yesterday, that when the church says, thou shalt not murder, the fifth commandment, or when God says it, and then the catechism has a huge section on all the ways we can kill each other, that there are at least 7 different distinct kinds of human life. Levels, rather, of human life. Because we are made in God's image, we have a spiritual life, which means that I can believe, I can ascend myself. I can go into my soul and touch the eternal God, right? So I can murder somebody's soul, spiritual life. I think that wasn't that the true horror of the sex abuse scandal, was that people associated the church and these priests with God himself and lost their faith. But someone could lose their psychological life, which is the ability to know reality because of the games that people play on them. Someone could lose their moral life, the ability to know good from evil, because we've made choices that have made them confused or bad example, whatever. Someone could lose their social life. They could lose the ability to trust and bond with others. They can lose their emotional life. They could lose the ability to feel empathy, to feel compassion, to feel outrage appropriately. Like, we can do that to each other. They could lose your intellectual life. You can lose the ability to learn and grow and know the truth. All of these things. So violence is depriving anyone of any aspect of their life. And I think that also we have sins of omission in this area. It's not just things I've done to people. It's the things I didn't do that allowed their lives to die. Now, we only really are going to have to atone for the things we meant to do, and the violent meant to do what they're doing on this level of hell, but they meant to do it. They put themselves in the occasion of being in the blood boiling river. They placed themselves there and let themselves enjoy that, all of that. So that's the warning to us, huh? Anyway, reminds me of when I saw The Passion. I was in Mel Gibson's office with him, and he came in afterwards and he said, "Yeah, didn't you love my movie? It's a real hoot." So I feel about Dante's Inferno. But anyway, any closing comments or thoughts? Yes.
When you mentioned the seven distinct levels of human life, you always said six.
Oh, I say, did you get intellectual, the last one?
Spiritual, psychological.
Oh, physical. Yes, the actual, we can actually kill each other's body. There's that, yeah. In some ways, much less a thing than some of these others. Excuse me?
Because they have to
live with it. Yes, that's true. They have to. Yeah, very good. Yes.
Yeah, just like what you were talking about, all the different ways we can cause that. And Christ, and brilliant, said, put it as if you cause one of the little ones to stumble. But
yeah.
He covered anything.
Oh, yeah.
He caused them to stumble anyway.
Yeah, yes. Woe to you if you cause one of these little ones a scandal, right? Yeah, to stumble. Yeah. Good. Okay, very good. Next week we talk about lies and malice. Yes, yeah, very fun. But then we're done with hell and we can work on cures in purgatory. Thank you very much. Good night.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Mystagogy Podcast. The music for the podcast is provided by George Serra. Learn more about his music in the show notes. Until next time, be well and God bless.